Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm your host, Darren Bresnitz. We are so excited to welcome back Michael Whiteman, president of Baum & Whiteman International Restaurant Consultants, for his annual sit-down and chat about all things culinary trends. 2023 is shaping up to be a big year with AI making menus, Mortadella making a big comeback, and the rise of hybrid meats. We talk about all this and more, some of his big buzzwords for this upcoming year. It's a pleasure. We love hanging out with him and so happy he was able to join us. So please sit back and relax and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on Heritage Radio Network.
Thank you. second up a little love, speaking desire. We cannot just begin. I miss you very much. To cry together every day, we have to stay in touch. And Jackie, baby, take my hand, smooth your tresses. Tears are falling on stocking tops, and newly sewn summer dresses. Oh, Jackie's kisses, Jackie's kisses, Jackie's kisses, Jackie's kisses. Oh, Jackie's kisses, Jackie's kisses, Jackie's kisses, Jackie's kisses.
We'll always be so much to be.
Michael, welcome back to Snacky Tunes for our annual restaurant food industry trend report. We're always honored to have you back. Happy New Year. Thanks for sitting down with us.
And Happy New Year to you, and glad we both made it through COVID.
Yes, yes. Me too. Did the restaurant industry make it through? We'll talk about that in a little bit. But what I wanted to start with today is AI, which has been in the conversation, it feels like, everywhere for the last few months, as it pertains to IP and art, even term papers, and has seemed to have this negative connotation in some ways on the creative process. But it's also made its way into the restaurant industry in a somewhat positive fashion, at least on the recipe development side of it. How is it integrating itself into the restaurant world?
Well, there's two aspects of this in the restaurant world. The first is the one that we've been reading about in the last month or so, which I discuss in my trends report for this year. And that's the image generator programs that are proliferating, where you type in your criteria. Image generator, give me a donut with lettuce and tomato and mustard filling. And the image generator will give you something that looks pretty much like that. Actually, the ability to do this has come, even in the last couple of months, quite a distance. In my trends report, I show a picture of the result of what happened when I put in chicken a la king into an image generator, and it gave me a picture of a chicken sitting in a plush armchair with the crown,
which was great. It's great.
Which was great.
Big back tattoo for you, I think, is also in your future for this year, right?
Yeah, but if I were a photographer who was used to being hired by restaurants to shoot pictures for their menus or their Instagram posts, and suddenly I discovered that the chef himself was putting in a cheeseburger with thick slab bacon and a portobello mushroom, and the image generator gave me that, and I just posted it. If I were a photographer, I'd be wondering what I would do for a living next week.
Sure. But are there any benefits to AI within the restaurant industry that doesn't result in the loss of creative jobs? Is it going to help with, you know, managing orders or even figuring out, you know, when surges in people coming? Does it even help with coming up with ideas for menus as sort of this nebulous sounding board?
Well, you asked two questions, so let's talk. Well, that's all right. It's your prerogative. It's your show. and it's my prerogative to answer one and ignore the other. On the operations level, it's very interesting because a manager or an owner of a restaurant has to juggle massive amounts of data, not even knowing it. Just getting up in the morning and looking out the window and seeing it's raining says to himself, how many people should I schedule today? And how many roast chicken should I roast? And how many of those chicken are going to be eaten on the premises and how many are going to be takeout? How many dishwashers should I schedule because it's raining and maybe people won't show up? And there's a myriad of those questions that a manager instinctively juggles in his head, but is very rarely accurate. But artificial intelligence, if you give it the right criteria, can juggle all of that and tell the manager who to hire, when to cook, how much to cook, when to move a dishwasher to peeling onions, and a myriad of other variables. That will happen, and it will make life easier for a creative owner, for example. Mm-hmm. It will eliminate a lot of jobs. Especially on the entry level. In addition, these artificial intelligence machines are programming other machines that will flip the hamburger, make your French fries. So far, they haven't got an omelet done yet, but they will. And that is going to wash out a lot of people in restaurant kitchens. And those people are these days probably the highest cost in running a restaurant.
But haven't we seen this before? And I feel like we've even talked about it in years past with these futuristic robot-run restaurants and things like that. How is this moment different than what we've seen in the past?
We have discussed it in the past, and I've discussed it in my trends for several years now. Just because I discussed it before doesn't mean we shouldn't be discussing it again.
Of course.
Plenty of advances. Using artificial intelligence allows, let's stay with the simple example of French fries, or fried food, allows a single machine to decide when you need more chicken wings. And if you don't need more chicken wings, well, maybe you need more French fries. If somehow the manager has hollered to the machine, make me more French fries, the machine will automatically say to the manager, don't you want chicken too?
Right.
So the more intelligent these machines become, the more useful they are to a manager, the higher efficiency the back of the house of a restaurant becomes. Mm. And what was 3 years ago a pipe dream for many people is now actually a reality. The Sweetgreen restaurant chain is, and we all know Sweetgreen because we've all spent our allowance on their salads.
It's a great salad.
Yeah, they are good salads. But they're opening two units in Boston that they say will be fully automated. I don't know how customers will necessarily accept seeing their food being made by a machine and interacting with a machine by punching their order in at a kiosk and having it come out packaged and ready to go. A former restaurant critic for the New York Times named Mimi Sheraton once was quoted as saying, food made by machines should be eaten by machines. We've gone way beyond that. The whole business of automation at this time where labor is short is really essential in the restaurant business. Whether it will affect in the near future, you're getting a Coco Van or your poached eggs hollandaise with smoked salmon. Not this year. And maybe never for certain kinds of restaurants. But even at the upper end of the price scale, there will be applications for this. Will it kill fine dining? No, it won't.
No. I mean, and how much discussion has been talked about the death of fine dining? And I feel like whenever there's a big news story or a big restaurant makes an announcement, there is always this hand-wringing of how the industry at whole will be affected.
Yeah. You're referring, I imagine, to the latest episode of the blaring headlines of Noma having closed.
Yes. And, well, an announcement of a closure in 2 years. Yes.
Yeah.
But yes.
Yeah. Well, at the end of that time, they may not close. We don't know.
We don't know. We don't know.
No, but the issue with all these hysterical headlines is that Noma's closing and it's the death of fine dining. Oh, I'm sorry about that. Noma can close all it wants to, and it will have absolutely zero impact on fine dining. It's one restaurant in Denmark where you get to eat boiled reindeer horns and lichen sauce mixed with who knows what they've scrounged up in the
lots of moss. I believe it's still a lot of moss.
Yeah. Noma has been a very influential restaurant among a high-level coterie of chefs who have taken techniques and ideas and applied them in the United States. But it's one restaurant. And if it closes, nothing else will happen. The subway will still run. The airplanes will still land. Yeah. The Republicans will still bicker. The headline writers and the food writers are always predicting the death of fine dining. And somehow it never dies. And it won't.
No. All right. Well, let's take a quick musical break, because when I come back, I do – want to talk about some of the shifts in the restaurants we're seeing, and then also get into some of the ingredients that you are loving for this year. We have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network. Back to Snacky Tunes. We are joined once again with Michael Whiteman, who is talking to us about all things restaurant and food industry trends. And I know earlier we were talking about restaurant and the cost of hiring people and how that has been such a factor that is going to be affected by technology. But it's hard to ignore. I think we have seen real inflation over the last few years. You know, the cost of eggs alone has doubled or tripled, even in some parts of the country. And it's even closed a few of our favorite spots. Conby comes to mind, which closed over this past weekend. Do you think we're ever going to see a world where these prices drop back down, or is this just the new cost of running a restaurant?
We always see a world where prices drop. Except maybe in real estate.
even that bubble, and I'm in Southern California, has dropped, not by much, but it has gone down.
Yeah, no, it goes down, and airfares go down too. And the price of filling your tank goes down as well. We're suffering from inflation, and we're suffering in two ways. We're on the cost of eggs that you mentioned, and also the cost of going out for two eggs, toast, and coffee, because those costs get passed on to a consumer. And restaurant prices have gone up considerably in the last year, maybe 10-12%. And the cost of goods that they've been buying has gone up probably around the same amount. And wages have gone up, but not quite as much. Wages won't come down, but the costs will come down. You will notice that the consumer packaged goods companies, people like General Mills, for example, or Pillsbury, are coining money hand over foot because they've discovered that as they raise their prices, consumers are continuing to shop.
Mm-hmm.
And that continued up until beginning of this month when consumers indeed began to pull back a little bit, but we don't know how much. But it will all settle out. It will settle out at a higher level. It always has. Mm-hmm. And then life will continue. But right now, for certain people, it's very bumpy. If you're on the lower end of the earning spectrum or even the middle income consumer, you're feeling the pinch because, if your rent goes up, which it does, it makes it harder to save for a house. You get caught in the trap of being a perpetual renter because you can never accumulate enough money to pay the down payment on a house. And even when you try to do that, the cost of toothpaste goes up and there goes your budget. On the other end, there are a large, large number of people making a lot of money. Or at least they were until the beginning of this month. And they've been spending like crazy. I don't know what it's like in Los Angeles, but on the top 50 restaurants in New York where I am, you can't get a reservation.
No, It's the same here. It's the absolute same here. Is that you either got to know someone, you got to book a month out. There's no walking in. And in fact, it's if you go to a restaurant and you happen to be in the eye line of the door on a Friday or Saturday night, and you watch people walk in with a reservation, there's no room for them. It's, everything's taken.
Among the high earners, they're spending like crazy. They're going on trips. Airlines are full. I just got back from Portugal, and I can tell you there were no seats on my airplane. I mean, no vacant seats. The no-seat airplane is coming, but not yet.
Oh, yeah, you just got to stand across the Atlantic. It's no problem.
One of the other interesting things that we're seeing is the rise of private clubs. You have them in L.A., and we for sure have them in New York and Chicago and Atlanta and London. These new private clubs are not the old ones like the Jonathan Club in L.A., for example, which has been there for 100 years and have a very, has a very specific kind of membership. These are clubs for new people who are making lots of money and are going to places where they want to be seen in exclusive surroundings, as opposed to an old club where you went because you didn't want to be seen.
Exactly.
Do
people expect good food or even name-worthy chefs, maybe not to be there, but to design the menus? Or are these just a way for, to your point, be a membership, seen and be seen, but the food is mediocre?
Well, there's a yes and a no answer to that. These clubs are boasting high levels of cuisine and very fancy prices, very often using a name chef as having been either in the kitchen or as a consultant, more often as a consultant than in the kitchen. Whether the food delivers that or not remains to be seen. The real social purpose of these clubs is to be able to be with a lot of high rollers like yourself, and well, yourself or myself.
Yeah. I mean, I have an easy $500,000 just to break off for my new private club. It's no problem.
Well, some of them are charging a couple of $100,000 worth of admission fees, people are throwing that money within the blink of an eye. Some people are throwing money at clubs that haven't even been built yet.
It feels so speculative. And it feels like even at the end of the day, the private independent restaurants still suffer because maybe instead of going to a new restaurant or something that's independent, people are taking that money and going to these private clubs and maybe not supporting the restaurants in their community. And in the long run, it seems like those middle-tier restaurants will probably be the ones that suffer because the high-end top 50 are booked and the fast casuals are getting maybe the lunch money. But those good spots that used to be ubiquitous are dying out.
Well, you know, your point is correct. However, I have to add that some new restaurants, especially the big trendy ones, are in fact opening private clubs as part of the restaurants. So you might have a restaurant on the first floor and a private club on the second floor. In addition to that, you might even have a restaurant on the first floor for the public and a private club on the second floor, and an exclusive private club on the third floor.
Right. Work your way up.
Yeah, that's called stratifying the market.
You know, look, we're talking about recession. We're talking about these different types of restaurants and things like that. I don't feel like it's the same as 2008, 2009. But are we going to see, should a recession hit, some of those similar trends or even some of the similar dishes that populated so many menus, the cheeseburgers, the fried chicken, or have some of those restaurants sort of already incorporated that strategy in the post-COVID world? I'm thinking of some place like our guest last week, Birdsong, which is a tasting menu up in San Francisco, who now also has Bird Box, which is a whole fried chicken type of restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Couple of things. Let me add to what I was talking about before on people spending vast amounts of money up until this month. Mm-hmm. We do not know. Nobody knows what the effect on the restaurant business will be from the 30 or 40,000 tech people that have been laid off in the last sure. 5 or 6 weeks. So the people who are blowing or were blowing wads of money last week on caviar, maybe eating canned tuna next week. So that's a big question in what will happen for the rest of this year in the restaurant industry. There are, to go back to your question, there are a large number of chefs who are running first-class restaurants, not necessarily very expensive, but just first-class restaurants,
mm-hmm.
who are facing enormous pressure on the cost ends of their business, and who believe that they run into a wall when it comes to raising prices. And they are experimenting with fast casual sorts of restaurants because the operating cost structure is much more favorable, specifically on the labor end.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, by the same token, a fair number of fast food places that are converting to fast casual. Again, because the operating numbers look better, especially since you get higher prices for pretty much the same food.
Yeah, yeah. And finally, the last question I have about restaurants is, now that we're in a new reality, post-COVID reality, and you could argue on what scale that is, we have seen a few stories come out about the return of the food influencer and how it has not always been positive. And I think for a few years, you saw people saying like, hey, it's tough enough to run a restaurant. We're not going to go after them. But now we're seeing these sort of, I don't want to say extortion, but I can't think of another word, of food influencers posting about not getting free food in return for reviews, or these very quick hits on social media of takedowns in restaurants. How are restaurants, now that they seem to be back in fair game as far as criticism go, how are they going to work with this type of relationship that sometimes helps? And I think of like the Las Vegas pizza story of the influencer who helped put that restaurant on the map, versus sometimes when it hurts and it's, you know, people saying awful things because they didn't get a free meal.
Well, you know, this has always been the case among certain levels of restaurant critics, and certainly among food writers, and even more certainly among food bloggers who think they're doing you a favor by coming in and having a free meal and shooting a few pictures. It's been accentuated, and I use the word badly, it's been badly accentuated by TikTok. To a large extent, TikTok can make a restaurant.
And it
can make a restaurant only because somebody posted a picture of a delivery boy walking through a fast food restaurant with his pants down.
Right, right.
And okay, so there's a stunt, and everybody suddenly discovers this restaurant, and there's a line. TikTokers themselves tend to be a vicious crowd when it comes to reviewing restaurants. So as fast as TikTok can make you, it can unmake a restaurant. And and that's one of the prices that we pay for the speed with which social media works.
Yeah. All right, let's take a quick break, and I come back, I want to talk about some of the ingredients that you're loving this year and some of the buzzwords that you're going to see are all over the place on restaurants and beyond menus and things like that. We have another song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
Cure all life, such a bore. when the lights are on.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old-world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are here with Michael Whiteman, and moving a little bit away from the restaurants themselves, one of the things I love about your annual trend list and reporting is your focus on ingredients, because I think sometimes what we cook with and what restaurants use tells a much, much bigger story. And none other, I think, than something that we covered in years past, but we seem to now be on the other side of its rise, are plant-based food, especially meat. And I know that when Beyond Meat came into the scene, we talked about how this was going to change the industry and even the environment. And that has not been the case. Dropping sales, a cliff dive in stock prices, and also, more importantly, a turn away from consumer interest for these plant-based meats. What happened, and is there any chance of them turning it around?
What happened is a complex confluence of consumer trends and inflation. Mm-hmm. But fundamentally, the plant-based food business, whether it's fermented mushroom roots, or whether it's a combination of various plant ingredients that are processed and flavored to taste like something else, turns out to have a very limited appeal. No, it has an appeal to a very limited group of people.
Yeah.
The upsurge and the great interest in plant-based foods came because lots of people were trying it.
Right, right.
Trying it is one thing, but buying it again is a second thing. And there's a lot of people who didn't buy again. So the plant-based industry at the moment is finding itself compressed into a niche market. And all of the valuations and all of the hype and all the articles that we've read have treated plant-based food as a second coming in the gastronomic world. So it hasn't been. I have to say that there are still large numbers of companies experimenting with plant-based foods, and even more important, and maybe even more durable, there are companies that are using cell-based fermentation techniques to create food that is a mimic of the actual food. That is to say, they're not taking plants and flavoring them to make them taste like meatloaf. They're taking cells from meat and fermenting them and making more cells and more cells and more cells, and then figuring out how to fabricate them so it tastes either like meatloaf or the Holy Grail is a real piece of steak. Hmm. And those are really interesting experiments taking place. The country that's far ahead in this, well, I'm not sure the word ahead is, the country that's highly prolific in this is Israel. And we don't see any of those products here. You are finding cell-based products in Singapore, where the regulations are far more lax than they are here. But we may see some this year.
There's another type of product that I actually hadn't heard of outside of, I would say, some of the sci-fi books I read, but this concept of hybrid meats. Can you explain what those are and how the FDA sees them and if we'll start seeing them on menus this year or in the relative future?
The notion of hybrid meats is trying to have your, you should pardon the expression, cake and eat it.
Sure.
The simplest example of a hybrid meat is a hamburger patty that's 50% meat and 50% mushrooms.
Mm.
And so by doing that, you've reduced your meat intake by 50%, if that's one of your objectives, and B, you've saved the planet from 50% worth of cow farts, because you're mixing the meat with mushrooms that are grown in caves, and apparently don't detract from the environment. So there are lots of experiments of mixing plant-based foods with actual meat. It seems to me that it might appeal to some of the people who tried plant-based foods and didn't like them, but now might be willing to give it a try. On the other hand, the diehard vegetarians in the world would not be happy about this.
No, no. Moving over to another piece of protein, and this is something I've seen a lot of in LA in the last few months, is this concept of dry aging fish, which I feel needs an explanation because, one, most people don't think you can eat old fish, and two, maybe isn't as new, at least in a Western palate, as we think it is.
Yeah, well, there's several things about that. A large portion of what you consider to be fresh fish is not necessarily fresh. It was caught on a boat and chilled, and it might be 10 days or a week before you get it.
Right.
But there's always been a question among fish specialists and certain chefs as to whether fresh fish is really ultra-fresh fish is really the best-tasting fish. And we all know that to get a proper steak, it should be aged at least 28 days. And if you want it to have that funky, beefy, umami taste and flavor, it should be aged even more than that. In the last 10 years or so, chefs have been aging poultry, which you wouldn't want to do in your own refrigerator, but they are, and there is a big tradition of this. It's called hanging your game.
So
people, certain numbers of chefs now are experimenting with aging fish. They hang it in an aging box, just like a side of beef, and it sits there for anywhere between 4 days and a couple of weeks, depending on how big the hunk of fish is and what kind of fish it is. And several things happen. Proteins in the fish become transformed. The fishy odor that many people find objectionable seems to disappear. And the flavor gets ramped up. It becomes the tuna tastes more tuna-y, and your striped bass tastes more striped bassy, and it's very difficult to explain. As I said earlier, I just got back from Portugal, where I did in fact eat in a restaurant that was dry aging its fish.
Amazing.
And the fish tasted like the fish I thought it would be, but its flavor was accentuated quite a bit. And I'm not sure that it would appeal to everyone.
No.
or would take some getting used to. But, you know, there are a lot of people who don't like aged meat because they can't stand the funk.
Yeah, some people just say, "I no age, no mold, no nothing. I just want it as fresh as I think it should be, even if it's not that fresh."
We're in a restaurant that I'm working on right now. We are serving dry aged meat for hamburgers.
I mean, I love that. I love that extra funk in a hamburger. I think it makes a difference.
Me too. My wife hates it.
Yeah, I mean, to each their own.
Yes, so I think the same issue will occur with fish. You know, you have to remember one of the great food writers and critics, Gail Green, died a few weeks ago. And there was a memorial service for her last week. And we were reminded that in the early days when she was writing, when she was under the influence of several chefs in France, that she began to write about rare fish. And until then, the thought of rare fish, somebody going into a restaurant and ordering medium rare tuna or medium rare salmon was never done, ever, in this country. So now we think nothing about going into a restaurant and saying, "I want my salmon medium rare or rare or black and blue." So these things do evolve, and we may learn that to like this. I mean, one of the benefits of dry aging fish is that it doesn't spoil.
No, it doesn't.
So it has a longer shelf life, which means that a restaurant doesn't have to deal as often and with the fish going bad.
You know, speaking of old becoming new again, you talk about the return of, and I didn't even know it was returning because it is actually one of my favorite meats, but mortadella, and also naming its longtime compatriot the pistachio as one of the meats of the year and the nuts of the year. Why have these returned? I mean, I'm asking mostly for the listener because they've never gone out of fashion for me. But for people who may have moved away from what they've seen as something that was processed or maybe not as high-end as a copa, prosciutto, why is mortadella back and why is pistachio coming along for the ride?
I have to confess, I don't have the faintest idea why mortadella is coming back, but it is. And we've called it the deli meat of the year because it is. I think it's perhaps a mass lunacy of chefs searching for the next available ingredient to resurrect something that's gone out of favor because it's hipster in its outlook, and so we're seeing mortadella on charcuterie boards where it never appeared before. We're seeing it on pizza. And I had it on a hamburger the other day. Again, testing it on that dry aged meat. I have to tell you, it helped. It was good. Why mortadella today? I have no idea. There is no mortadella association that promotes this kind of thing.
Now, you have a few other buzzwords and trends that are coming up for this year. And while we can't hit all of them, there are a few that I did want to touch on. You talk about bomba. What is that for those who don't know?
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Bomba?
Bomba.
Oh. Yes.
Yeah. When you go to an Italian restaurant, more often than not, you'll see the phrase Calabrian chili. Calabrian chili is a breed all its own. In southern Italy, there are jars of it called bomba. It's labeled bomba. You can buy it here in our country, except it's called Calabrian chili, and it comes in the form of a paste or it comes up in the form of chopped Calabrian peppers, which are extremely hot, but they have actually have a flavor. It's not just plain heat. The reason that I listed it is A, because I have seen Calabrian chili peppers on menus growing over the last 2 years, and B, because I'm willing to bet that there's no Calabrian pepper in the kitchen because it's more expensive. But it's not like shaking the pizza, you know, crushed up pizza pepper on your on your noodles. It's another flavor, and you can buy it in mail order, or if you've got a good supermarket, which we don't in New York, but you do where you are.
Sure,
you'll find it on the shelves.
Let's talk about fried cheese sticks, which again is something that has never gone out of fashion for me. But I realized the other day when I got them from the local pizza spot, I haven't had them in forever. And now seeing them on this list, I was like, oh, maybe they are making a comeback.
Well, it's partly in the mortadella category. But, you know, fried cheese sticks still exist in places like TGI Fridays and Bennigan's, sure. Which is probably where you grew up eating them. And they became, as far as the restaurant world is concerned, de classe. For the same reason that mortadella had become
never in my book.
Yeah, you know, it's a blue collar cheese. But chefs are experimenting not with the rubber cheese that you get in the typical mozzarella stick, but with fresher mozzarella, actual fresh mozzarella, and other cheeses that will hold up in the fryer without exploding. Once you've had one of those cheese sticks, you'll discover that it's not like eating in Bennigan's, and your mouth will thank you.
And finally, as we start to look to the future, as we do every year, but the concept of waste is always at the forefront, especially in the restaurant industry. I know LA just added composting to its general services for garbage takeout. You talk about upcycling waste, and this sort of does tie back to inflation, and we've seen it before with, you know, like no waste menus and things like that, which I know came something that Dan Barber was a huge proponent of. But how are we going to see this more, and how is this going to be something that's going to be palatable to diners who might not be used to eating, let's say, strawberry tops and carrot skins?
Many, many, many years ago, I was on a trip in the South, just observing what was going on in the restaurant industry, particularly in the fast food diners and coffee shop end of the world. And I was walking through a kitchen with the owner of one of the restaurant chains, and he saw somebody prepping broccoli. And the kid was chopping off the broccoli tops and throwing the rest in the garbage pail. And the owner fished it out, and he called the manager over and said, you're throwing away half of what I just bought.
Right.
And if you can't figure out what to do with this on your menu, I'm here to help.
Right.
So this issue of waste is not anything new. I think what's happened is that there's a level of virtue signaling about the environment that says that we should use every last bit, which we should.
I agree.
There are lots of things you can do with the broccoli stems. We don't throw ours out, and we don't throw out the stems from the cilantro or the parsley. We do use carrot tops in pesto. I think all this is beneficial for the restaurant industry and for people at home. It's also beneficial psychologically because you think that you're doing something to save humanity.
Yeah.
How much of that is marginal and how much of it is real is an open question. But not throwing things away is a good idea. And, you know, I'm old enough to have grown up when you didn't throw anything away. You had it repaired.
Yeah. Well, listen, Michael, I cannot thank you enough. Always a pleasure to read the report. And then always a pleasure to sit down and chat with you. If people want to read the report or get in touch to work with you, where can they go to communicate?
They can look up. What the easiest thing to do is to type in the words Michael Whiteman, two words, and trends. And you'll find me.
Very true. Very true. Well, Michael, thank you so much. Thank you for taking the time to share your insights and everything. We have one last song from the archives, and then we will see you next week here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
To the test, girl, I'm under arrest. No, we won't sleep till the streets are clean and the levee broke now. We got fire before smoke somehow. The results are in. Negatives are positive, 'cause I'm a prisoner of love. When it rains, it pours. Oh, we're not jumping up now. You'll take me back in your arms. Behind bars, no more living large, girl. We're flirting with danger, whoa. Dancing with strangers. Now it's just you and me, girl. Inmate number 715203. Yeah, you will be my captor. Sunshine, my big time, my laughter. 'Cause I'm a prisoner of love. When it rains, it pours. Oh, when I toughen up now, you'll take me back in your arms. Prisoner, yeah, I'm a prisoner of love. It's pouring so hard. Yeah, we're not coming out now. No. Talk ain't always cheap now. I made a promise that I'm gonna keep somehow. Show you what I'm made of. A little prisoner, no prisoner, yeah, prisoner. Prisoner of love, whoa, whoa. When it rains, it pours. Yeah, when I toughen up now, won't you take me back in your arms? Prisoner of love, just a little prisoner of love.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Snacky Tunes is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaili, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.